All right, our next speaker is Dr. Jonathan Lundgren, and he is going to be talking about conserving insect function in organic farming systems, predation, and pest management.
Right. Hello there, everybody. Let me get rid of that. I'm John Lundgren. I am an insect ecologist and agroecologist. I'm going to be talking a lot about predators today. We're going to be starting more conceptually, but I promise we'll try to get more into the applied stuff towards the end. We've got some new data, and then we've got some very old data, 10 years. I went into the Wayback Machine to dredge up some cool stuff. So here we go. I'm giving two talks, and they're actually falling in the wrong order. So tomorrow is going to be a talk about diversity and stuff. It's on the docket. Rest assured, if you do not believe me, cornfields have fewer pests when they have high species diversity, greater biological network strength. If you do not believe me, just come to the talk tomorrow, and I'll substantiate that in great detail. So it really begs the question, if as these more diverse systems, as these communities become more diversified, how is it that diversity contributes to pest management? I think that's the mechanisms involved there is very important. And I also believe that at least initially we have some ideas on what mechanisms may be playing a role there. It may be in terms of reducing pest densities, it may be making the plants less apparent to those pests. It may be increasing predators in efficacy or diversity, such that there's greater niche complementarity and filling those different niches. But honestly, I'm not sure that we're ever going to know all of the ways, all of the mechanisms whereby this works. But certainly, biodiversity inherently provides services and performs function that no matter how we try, history has consistently explained to us that it cannot be replaced through our mechanisms. One of these mechanisms whereby diversity is fairly well established in how it works is predation. So here we see a soybean aphid oozing out some of its cornicles, this defensive secretion. This is an aureus insidiosus sucking its blood out. Very cool stuff. Predation and pest management. So there's a little bit of a debate in the ecological literature as we increase diversity of a predator community within a particular habitat, what happens to the focal pest, a focal pest? Because as you increase diversity of a predator community or the abundance of a predator community, what are those things going to eat? Well, they're going to eat each other, at least in some level. And so does that release a target pest or does that contribute to a target pest suppression. This is the study system that I'm going to introduce this talk with. This is the corn rootworm system. So corn rootworms, some of you guys know about this pest. It's one of the most renowned pests of agriculture in the world. It's been recognized as a pest for about 100 years. Literally millions of research dollars have been spent on trying to manage this pest. The larvae eat the corn roots. The corn plants are physiologically damaged. They're also mechanically damaged. They fall over. Very difficult to harvest. And one thing that we've learned over the years in all of these millions of dollars in research is that anything we throw at the corn rootworm, they chew it up, they spit it out, and then they flip us the bird. So I think that what we need is we need a different approach to this topic, right? I think we need to redesign systems where the corn rootworm isn't a pest to begin with. So when I began, I was assured by people that had been studying the corn rootworms for their entire careers that there simply are no natural enemies of corn rootworms, and therefore this is really not something that you should be studying. This is not something to waste your time on. So we ended up, and understandably so, okay, because this is a consistent pest, and it's also a very difficult pest to study the predators community on. Through years of research, we have, I think, dispelled this myth that even though it is a subterranean pest, we've developed tools for detecting within predator stomachs rootworm-specific DNA sequences so that we can actually look inside the stomachs of predators that are collected in situ in the field to figure out which ones had been consuming corn rootworms as well as the amount of cornworm DNA within their stomachs. And we've also used sentinels in order to show that as predation goes up on these larvae within particular cornfields, we find that root damage inflicted by those corn rootworms ends up going down. Thus, predators are having an impact on corn rootworms. So, the corn rootworm, because of its economic importance, it became a really a relevant system to try to study this question of, as we increase biodiversity within a cornfield, what happens to the predator's reliance upon this specific pest? So what we did is we looked in over 2 years, 8 fields annually, so a total of 16 cornfields. We artificially infested these cornfields with our handy-dandy corn rootworm infester. This is calibrated to dribble in 1,000 corn rootworm eggs per row foot. So we put these in there, into each of these cornfields, and then we took soil cores, and we collected the pests, and then we also looked at the predator communities that were living within the soil column. We cut off their heads, we chopped off their butts, and we ripped out their stomachs. That is right here. This is a carabid beetle stomach. And we looked inside for corn rootworm DNA of 2,000 predators and independent PCR reactions. So this is what we found. Dozens of predator species. This is the proportion positive in each of these predator species. The numbers above are the number of fields that we found those particular predators in. And this would be what a lot of predator ecologists would spend, you know, literally like 3-4 manuscripts just trying to tease out this hairball. I mean, look at this thing. Is this the most important predator because it has 100% positive for rootworm DNA, but it was only collected in one field? But down here, you know, I mean, these guys down here, they're collected in every field, but they don't have as high of a signature. And these guys down here, who knows what's going on? And this one likes to tickle this one. And this just becomes this really difficult situation to try to understand. And functionally, as a farmer, they don't care. Right? What they're interested in is this. Or at least they should be interested, is in this. Per field, what is that predator community as a unit doing out there? Because these predator communities, I believe, should be examined as a functional unit. Because they change. They change over time. They change over across, within a field even. They change over the season. So when we look at these 16 cornfields, we find that 6% of those predators ended up testing positive for corn rootworm DNA. So at first glance, I mean, I would forgive people for saying that this is not that big of a deal, right? 6% of the predators is not a very high return until you realize a little bit more about this method. 6% of the predators in these cornfields ate corn rootworm DNA within the last 8 hours. Because after you eat a meal, after the corn rootworm predators eat a meal, they instantly start to digest that food's DNA such that really it's only detectable for a narrow window of time. Okay, so 6% of these predators ate that within the last 8 hours. 6% of 2,000 predators, that's not very many. When we do actual density samples within real cornfields, we find that there are up to hundreds of millions of predators per acre out in these cornfields, especially people that are, some of these farmers that are using soil health or have a high value for soil health practices like no-till and cover cropping. So 6% of a million predators in the last 8 hours starts to become a very significant impact on those corn rootworm populations. The other thing that was nice about this is that there's error bars. That means that in each of these cornfields, we had a variance in our signature. That means that each cornfield had a different level of predation, which then gives us the opportunity to look at the diversity of a corn insect community within that field versus the return or the signature of the gut content analysis, the predation pressure on the corn rootworm in that same cornfield. So what we find is that as predators become more abundant, here's the predator abundance here. This is the frequency of predation over here, and each of these dots is cornfield. As the predator abundance increases, so too does their reliance on corn rootworm as prey. As predator diversity within that cornfield increases, their reliance on corn rootworm starts to become more intense. Why would that be? Why would predators rely more heavily on corn rootworms as we saturate that predator community? It doesn't necessarily make sense. Why would they not be inflicting as high a level when there isn't as many predators out there? And I think it comes back down to this right here. We've all received one of these over the years, right? At least I hope we all have. The orange cream is always the last chocolate in that box. Right? Sometimes somebody takes a bite and then puts it back in. We've all seen that. I believe that corn rootworms are the orange creams of the prey world, such that as we saturate predator communities with diversity, with abundance, we're forcing them to eat those things that they don't necessarily like. And I have a video to demonstrate that. Here's a corn rootworm larva. Here's one of my big grizzly predators. She comes along. She takes a bite. So this, incidentally, is exactly what my kids do when I tell them that lasagna is being served for supper. They start freaking out, right? Start flipping over, like legs and arms flipping all over the place. Look at that thing. The corn rootworms, we've been studying the corn rootworm for 100 years, and we have not uncovered that the corn rootworm, its blood is actually repellent, if not toxic, to predators, at least some predators that were out there. It instantly coagulates on the predator's mouth parts, and there's also a chemical fraction that is repellent to certain other predators. So what we end up seeing then is that corn rootworms are an unpalatable prey item, right? And so if my theory is correct, then what we're seeing is as we saturate predator communities, then those predators should rely more on distasteful, the orange creams. Okay, so what we found is that this predator's defense is only effective against certain cohorts, or certain parts of the predator community. Those predators that have piercing, sucking mouth parts seem to be much less affected by the predator's defense than those with chewing mouth parts, like my beetle. And this is demonstrated here at the egg stage as well as the larval stage of the pest. Chewing predators have a lower prey consumption index, which is based on that gut content analysis I showed you before, and sucking predators less so. So what we would then imagine is that those sucking predators would eat corn rootworms regardless of their prey density, or regardless of the predator's density and abundance. And that's what we find over here. Proportion positive in the sucking predators versus diversity. But over here with our chewing predators, what we see is that this pattern returns, which means that those chewing predators are regarding their prey as being problematic, and the only way that they're going to rely on those is by being forced, by being saturated. So we need as much predator diversity within our cropland as we can possibly get in order to overcome some of these distasteful pests. And honestly, many of the pests that we end up contending with, and indeed many herbivores in general, but particularly pests, are well known to have various anti-predator defenses. So how do we get more predators into cropland is the question, right? Well, we need to reduce disturbance and we need to increase diversity. Very simple conceptually, sometimes practically, not so easy. I'm going to go back in a time machine back to 2003 and 2004. Back really the last time, although I work in a lot of themes that would work really well on organics, I don't actually work on a lot of organic farms right now. But this was one that we did. We were trying to figure out different strategies for transitioning to organics and how those affected the entire system. This was all done down at the Illinois Natural History Survey. It was sort of a pseudo postdoc that I did down there with Kathy Eastman, Ed Zaborski, John Shaw, John Masunis, Darren Eastburn, Michelle Wander, Leslie Cooperband, lots of people involved in this project. And what we were asking is, what is the best way to transition to organics? But what I was asking is, of these three different strategies that we were going to evaluate, which ones did the insects, the beneficial insects, the friendlies, which one favored them the most? So this is how the project was sort of structured. It all started out as one big old plot of rye, and then they went into a low-intensity treatment with high diversity, and which was basically this perennial lay system. Then there was a second treatment. This was an intermediate intensity treatment, which was basically a cash grain system. In our years of study, it was soybeans and then wheat in the second year. And then the third was a very high disturbance, high intensity system for producing vegetable crops. So these were three general approaches that organic farmers were using to try to get to their organic from a conventional system. So they weren't taking in a lot of income, the added income from an organic crop, but they still had to they still had to make money, right? And they wanted to choose the most efficient one to use. So this study was conducted over 2 years while I was there. It actually was a three-year study. But what we were interested in is what happened with the insects in these. So what we did is we looked, we did actual density samples on the soil surface using quadrat samples. So we would put a quadrat down and then we would actually aspirate up insects. And then we would also look at predation. So here we find that a restrained larva, a sentinel larva, this is a waxworm, with a pin stuck through its butt, and then they actually survive for a really long time out in the field, and then you can put them out there, recollect after an hour to see who's coming and eating those things. So here we see a little a lampyrid or a cantharid larva, soldier beetle larva, eating this waxworm. And then we also looked at seed removal rates in these different treatments over the 2 years. So we put a known number of seeds to study the granivore communities. We put a known number of seeds out there, and then we collected those up after a couple of days, and then we would see how many seeds were consumed. What did we find? Well, number one, the most diverse and most abundant predator communities were found in this low-intensity, high-diversity system. Intermediate had, I mean, it followed exactly, it behaved exactly the way it was supposed to, right? Where we see this diminishing, and this was in the day and in the middle of the night. So we went out there and actually did nocturnal sampling. So again, we're getting at the same theme as I was presenting to you before in the corn system, where we have this dispersion of diversities of predators and more abundant predators in these different systems. And this is what we found as far as the response. Number one, we found the highest services being predation on weed seeds and predation on insect pests were found in this highly diversified systems. We found that 63% of weed seeds were consumed per week in this highly diverse system. This was 28% higher than the cash grain system and 78% higher than the vegetable system. Same pattern over here as we saw in this corn system earlier. As predator abundance increases, the number of prey consumed also increases right alongside. So predator diversity and prey consumption seems to be linked there. Not only that, but this is also really important right here, the lay system. After these transition strategies were over, we planted all of the different treatments to soybeans, and we looked at the yield responses. Lay system had 42% higher soybean yields than the other two systems. So we really, I mean, this is where we were going. It had the most productivity in terms, it had the lowest cost inputs, and it also had the greatest ecosystem services. Diverse insect communities reside within farmland. And our decisions, our management decisions, influence the impact that those services can have in terms of the bottom line. Two key habitat characteristics associated with really functional systems relate to low habitat disturbance, things like low tillage, low pesticide use, and high biodiversity. And that starts with vegetation diversity. I think that we need to, rather than our traditional approach, which is to wait until the pest goes crazy and react to it, I think that we need to take a step back and we need to start redesigning our cropping systems using ecosystem processes and understanding of ecosystem processes, reincorporating those back into our cropland so we're designing systems where pests aren't a problem to begin with. Nothing that I do, nothing that I presented here today would be possible if it was not for the tremendous students and contributors that I have in my laboratory. They make coming to work every day a hell of a lot of fun. A lot of people, colleagues, professional colleagues, also really contributed a lot here. Here's my email address. NEPA funded a lot of the research that you see, as well as ARS. And with that,
I have time for a couple of questions.
Do I?
Yeah,
okay.
About 2 minutes for questions.
All right. That was a lot of info.